This is Things Police See, first-hand accounts, with your host, Steve Gold.
Welcome to the podcast that interviews active and retired police officers about their most intense, bizarre, and sometimes humorous moments on the job. I am your host, Steve Gould. Thank you for being here, everybody. Thank you for coming back to listen to more. And thank you to you new listeners who are just checking it out. If you just discovered the show and you really love it, I would encourage you to give that 5-star Apple podcast review. It really helps us out. Just kind of makes us look good. I hear it really doesn't do all that much for algorithms or whatever, but when people are going to look at law enforcement shows, they see all the 5 stars and they like that, and it gets more guests. It keeps keeps me feeding the beast with more and more people coming on, so I appreciate it. If you really love the show is brought to you always by Patreon and the supporters over there. The link to Patreon is in the show notes. It's basically like it's like a Facebook page you get access to for donating to the show. There's a couple different tiers, and it's for the hardcore fan that really loves it. If it's not in your budget or you can't afford it, not a big deal. The show's going to remain free always, so max amount of people can hear the stories from the men and women of law enforcement. But if you do really love the show, that's the best place to show your support. I'm always super excited when I get that little ding on my phone and there's a new Patreon supporter. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all that. Today's episode is an exciting one. This is a guy that's been on before, and it's one of those interviews. Well, I'm interviewing him. I'm feeling like he has so many more stories. We could just keep talking. And even after the interview, we chatted privately. He does indeed have a lot more stories. I'm super happy to have him back on. Let's give you his intro so you can, he's been a while since he's been on, just so you can kind of get a brief background of his policing. During his career in law enforcement, best-selling author David Putman has worked in narcotics, violent crimes, criminal intelligence, hostage rescue, SWAT, and internal affairs, to name just a few. He's the recent of many awards in recipient, oh boy, of many awards and commendations for heroism. The Reckless is a 6th novel in the best-selling Bruno Johnson crime series, following the Disposables, The Replacements, The Squandered, The Vanquished, The Innocents, The Reckless, The Sinister, and The Scorned. And I know for a fact he has some more books coming out. Credible author, very popular. Without further ado, let me bring on your guest, the great David Putnam. Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. I'm glad to get you back on, man. I feel like you're in Hawaii when I look behind you there.
Yeah, my wife's from Hawaii, and she put that background up.
I like it. I dig it. Do you do any surfing?
I used to when I was younger, yeah.
It's almost like it's an obligation to do when you're a Southern California guy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Absolutely. Man, so you are a fan favorite. Your stories were really, really fun, especially for me for that first episode you were on, because you had stories of running and gunning around the city of Ontario, and you were naming streets that I routinely drove up and down. So it's really cool to have you on that first time, and I'm happy you could come back again. Dave, I wanted to ask you what year it was that you started policing?
Well, I started as a sheriff's explorer in probably 74. I became a police cadet in 77, 78.
Okay.
And then I went through the academy in 79.
So you're the perfect guy to ask this, because you, I want to ask you what the climate of policing was like then. And what I mean is, like, what was morale like, and what was the culture of policing? Like, what, when you got on the job, what were your supervisors telling you to do? What was the point of you going on patrol? Because I hear now from friends from larger cities, they're being told things that are like the opposite of what a normal person would think you would tell police to do. They're very worried about liability. They're very worried about race relations. They're very worried about angering protected groups. What was it like when you started, and what were they telling you?
Well, when I came on, I was still there was 95 cops at Ontario when I first came on. The city was about 100,000, and they were still hiring Vietnam veterans. So I got put back a little bit because they gave Vietnam vets extra points for hiring. And so some of the Vietnam vets that were still working when I came on, they were paycheck kind of guys. They were just doing a job to get the paycheck, and they did a good job, but they didn't go looking for trouble. So the department at the time, in the briefings, they never said, don't get into trouble. They always said, go out and arrest. Find the bad guys. They would brief on robberies and burglaries, and they would want those curtailed. So they would tell us to go get them. The biggest thing I remember is they were always harping on officer survival. Be safe. They would brief that every day. That was because there were a lot of things happening. The Corona robbery of the bank, that running shootout happened. It's a very famous shootout. There's a book about it now. Where a Riverside cop was killed in Battle Creek at the termination of that pursuit. And LA County SWAT came out and hunted the guy down in the mountains. One of the guys that was shooting homemade grenades out the back of the truck at the cop cars. And I just missed that, getting in that pursuit by 15 minutes because my shift had just ended. I was on day shift at the time, and the robbery happened, drove through the Ontario at swing shift. So, there was a good friend of mine that was shot in the line of duty in Ontario. So they were just hammering the officer survival aspect of it. And there was nothing about the liabilities or watch what you're doing kind of thing. They just wanted us to go out and be safe and take people to jail.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really, I kind of thought that might be the answer. It sounds like a lot simpler way to go about your job. I mean, even around in the Northeast where I am, there's been just a general softening of almost everything from very low level crimes, like driving suspended or unlicensed or revoked registration. Like they used to, when my dad started in the 70s, like if you could be arrested for an offense, they were arresting you. There wasn't a whole lot. If you were unlicensed driving, you're being arrested. The courts were busier because they arrested for every level of crime. And where I am, they've kind of, now it's kind of, if you arrest somebody for straight up unlicensed, it's kind of, you hear that on the radio and you're kind of like, whoa, he must have pissed him off if he's arresting him, you know? But my dad tells me, we arrested everything. You catch a kid with a beer, arrested. Like everybody is going in cuffs. And I think that was just kind of, it wasn't a big deal. It was just kind of like, yeah, the cops arrested me type of thing. It was like, yeah, I broke the law. People kind of had this general agreement that I broke a law, I got arrested. And now it's like, it kind of seeped through the system here where it's like, when you start not really hammering the low-level stuff, well, eventually the upper stuff has been softened too. So people aren't even getting sentences for real crime.
Right.
It's kind of unbelievable.
Especially in California. They there's no longer a penalty. You don't go to prison for second degree burglary or stealing a gun or grand theft. All those crimes, you just get jailed. You do 2 days in jail till your case goes to court. You get convicted and you're let out again. They decriminalized rape and child molest. It's no longer a violent crime. It's still a felony, but they declassified it so they could cut the budget for parole. So parole no longer tracks those people. But when I was coming up, the cops had this saying, if you were a go-getter, and they would talk about it, there was misdemeanors were Marys and felonies were Franks. And the saying was that if you let the Marys go, you're going to piss off the arrest gods and they're not going to give you any Franks. So you had to pick them up. You had to take the Marys to get the Franks.
Right. That's funny. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, Southern California, when we had our car stolen twice, when we lived there for 4 years, and granted LAPD's undermanned and they're busy and whatever, but that really is like reporting your mailbox got smashed. Like, it's like, they're like, uh-huh. I'm like, well, with my brain, I'm like, are you going to send a unit to Canvas for Ring cameras or, you know? They're like, no, you can come to the station and report it. And they didn't, there was no investigation at all. They just don't investigate it because, you know, for all those different reasons, they're busy and it's not a felony. So it's like,
that's another crime that you don't go to prison for. And when I was coming up, they had the 10851 award, which was the code section for Grand Theft Auto. And so the insurance companies, I think it was the biggest insurance company, would give out this award every year. So if you got you got 10 ducks, a duck was a sitting car with nobody in it, and two rollers, you were eligible for the award. And then if you got a chop shop and then, you know, five ducks, it was just a percentage because the insurance companies were taking it in the shorts for it. So they wanted to promote the cops going after the Grand Theft Autos. But I don't think they're doing it anymore because there's no penalty for it. You don't go to prison for it anymore.
That's interesting. So the insurance company would actually incentivize it. They'd give out little.
Exactly.
Wow, yeah, that's cool.
And then you could move up. So you would get a blue pin the first time that went on your, you were allowed to wear on your uniform. And then you would next pin would be a gold pin, and you keep moving up in different colors.
That's cool. Like a colonel by the end of your career. I mean, the only company I hear of doing anything like that now is Stinger, the ones with the spike strips. If you spike strip a car, they will send you like a little scorpion pin. No one wears them, but that's the only company I hear of like giving you any kind of recognition for, you know, helping them out, you know?
Well, those, the bait cars came from the insurance companies. We didn't build those. The insurance companies gave them to us. You know, the ones that has the automatic ignition set off. So you'd put a nice car in an area and it would get stolen and we would be watching it and they'd take off and we just shut the car down and walk up on them and take them to jail. I don't think they're even doing that anymore.
That's awesome. Yeah, when I was at Backgrounds, I worked with a guy who was a captain for the CHP, and he was head of that, at one point in his career, head of that auto theft task force. And he said he would tell stories like that when they would, you know, they had like elaborate things to set people up for stealing cars. Right. And it was all totally controlled. Very, very cool. Now they don't care at all. It's like just,
I don't think they care at all, man.
Not at all. Dave, I wanted to ask you a question because you've worked so many different specialties in your career. Do you have a story or something memorable from specifically working narcotics cases?
When I was working violent crimes, I was chasing bank robbers and murder suspects. Now, we would cross sworn as U.S. Marshals, and we would chase them across three states. But then I met my wife, and I wanted a calmer schedule. And so I went to work in the airport. I worked narcotic interdiction at the airport. And that was a lot of fun. They gave me a card that had 10 points on it. And this is not racial profiling, it's criminal profiling. So one would be new hard side suitcases. One was cash one-way tickets. One is arrive last minute run for the airplane kind of thing. This was back before 9/11. And you could still get to your plane real quick.
Like OJ in the commercial.
Yeah, exactly. So I would sit up. I was still wearing my Grace Trucking shirt, Carl Grace Trucking, my John Deere ball cap, and I would sit in the terminal and do crosswords. I love doing crosswords. And I would watch for the people on the card. And so LAPD was an LAPD task force because Ontario Airport was owned by LAPD, LA City for a while, for many years, and they just got it back. But they had five or six LAPD guys in the office, and they were all old narcs who had spent 25 years in narcs, and they would just stay in the office, put their feet up on the desk. Some great guys. I mean, I had fun talking to them. They had some great stories. Two DEA agents, four deputies. So there was quite a few guys. But I was the only one that stayed out in the terminal all the time. And so I get on the radio and said, "Hey, I got a five." And they come back, "We're not coming out for a five." You know, on the card. One time I called them, I said, "Hey, I got a 10. And they grab their stuff. They come running out because it's going to be a good caper. And it's this old Hispanic guy and pushing an older Hispanic woman in a wheelchair. And they come out and I talk on the radio and I say, "He's right there." And they go, "Oh, man, that's not a narcotic trafficker." And I said, "It matches the card perfectly. It's a 10. So they put their hard side luggage on the conveyor belt. It goes in the back. And we had a dog, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's, a friend of mine, a detective, had a dog. A dog keyed on a suitcase. So I made the contact, showed him, you know, my badge, and real casual, and asked him if we could search their suitcase. And both suitcases were loaded with dope. They were loaded with heroin, marijuana, and meth.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So what about a 10 Can you describe to us why you picked that, why you keyed in on it, and what made it like a, what set off an alarm for you?
Because they had all 10 items. They fit the profile perfectly. You know, they were, they got there last minute. They had, cash one-way tickets, which is huge. They had hard sides. I forgot all of them, what they were. And it's because it's been so long. And so if I wanted to get money, I would sit at the gates, the arrival gates. I'd go out there and just stand there and watch. And many times these guys would come off the plane and they're high-stepping. And it looks like they're wearing high heels, but they're in tennis shoes. And I walk over and identify myself. Hey, can I talk to you? What do you got in your shoes? And I sit them down right there. They take their shoes off. 10 grand in each shoe. It was always 10 grand in each shoe. And it was always, oh yeah, I'm here to buy cattle, or I'm here to buy shoes. And no, you can't have that money. You can't. So then they'd sign the money over to me. One guy, he was like a four coming off the plane. And I just did a cold contact because I was bored out at the curb. And he had this big steamer trunk. And I said, hey, what do you got? You got anything in there you're not supposed to have? And he goes, I got some money. I go, how much money you got? He goes, $50,000. So I pick up the steamer truck and put it on my shoulder. And I walk with him to the office. And I get him in the office. And I sit down, and other coppers are still talking. They're not paying attention because I'm always doing something. And I open it up, and it's got a foam inset, and there are these really high dollar cameras with long lenses and things in it. And so I take the cameras out, set them down carefully, pull the foam out, and the thing's empty. And I look at the guy and I said, I thought you had $50,000 in here. And this is what he says. He says, well, you dumbass, it's got a false bottom. Like that. Well, he calls me a dumbass.
Wow. And tells you where it is.
And he could have got away with it if he had not been a jerk. So we pulled the false bottom out, and he had $50,000, which he was a dope dealer, and we took it from him.
What's the threshold when you were doing that for too much cash? Is there a FAA rule, or is there just
I think it's a federal law that you can't have more than $10,000 when you're flying. When you're moving money, you can't have more than $10,000. Gotcha. That's what it used to be. It might have changed.
At least gives you the opening for a threshold inquiry to start questioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we'd have a call come in from another airport saying, "Hey, you need that we get tips." And at the time, there was this guy was the Dallas Fort Worth, and this guy was like gold. He had one of the cards. The profile cards. So when somebody came up to buy a ticket, he would flag them and call whatever airport. And DEA was paying him at that time. This was 1994. This guy was making $300,000 to $500,000 a year, DEA payouts. So wow. His his job, if they found out about it, they're not supposed to do it. They would fire him. But he was making his paycheck for the airline was nothing compared to the money that he was getting from the DEA. So he would call us, and we knew it was a good tip. So sometimes we'd hit them right away when they come off the plane, or we would get in our cars and we'd follow them. And this one old crotchety DEA guy, LAPD guy, he was a D3, and he had a lot of time on. And the guy would get in a car and take off, the crook. And so we got to get in our cars and be right on him. So he would pull up with his badge and show the parking lot guy his LAPD badge. Open the arm. I got to get out. Open the arm and get out. No, sir, you have to pay that, And three times he just gunned it and broke the arm off and drove right through.
Wow.
Three different times. It was funny. And we followed guys, all over Southern California to bigger and develop bigger conspiracies from the airport caper. You know, we'd set up in our hotel and watch them and we put a camera one time on a tray of food outside a room. And it was a lot of fun, but it wasn't the same as chasing murder suspects or violent criminals. It was just, I tell people that when I was on violent crimes team, I was hunting grizzlies. And when I went to the airport, I was hunting for salmon because, the magnetometers, you couldn't bring a gun or a knife. One fool had a kilo of cocaine strapped to his chest, and he went through the magnetometers and it went off and he started running and chased him and tackled him. But he'd wrap his cocaine in tin foil.
What an idiot.
I know.
Oh my God.
Both kind of stories. But
you could really, you could, I mean, I know people my age, I've met people my age that were old enough to fly before TSA and all that became a thing after 9/11 that did move big amounts of like drugs on planes. And it was like, so you kind of, it's easy to forget, but it was like the Wild West. As you, if you could get in and out without getting a, getting near a dog or a cop, you could do it. You could move drugs.
Right. Well, and then that's what they thought. You know, they would, these guys were coming in with 20 grand. They would send 5, 10, 15 at a time. And they had a certain amount that they accounted for loss. They knew they're going to lose some. And when, you know, 80% got through, they were happy. Same thing with the drugs.
Because it was,
One time I came to work and everybody's running to the different places. And to, there was one tower because there was a new tower was built. And all these guys from my division were running to this tower. Like, what's going on? There's a plane coming in for a crash landing. And so we got up on this tower because it was closed up, but we had the, you know, we had the badge. So we got up there. And what happened was this plane was coming into Burbank and his, the wheel didn't want to go down. So it was one wheel up and one wheel down. So Ontario has a 2.5 mile long runway, so they always divert those kind of things to Ontario. And so the plane went over the ocean, dumped its fuel, and then came in for a high risk landing. And we're up to watch. We see this plane come in with one wheel, you know, one wheel in the front and one wheel in the back, and the other wheel wasn't up. And it was a woman pilot, and she touches down, and the plane just stays on one wheel all the way down, and then tail almost comes to a stop, and it goes dink, and the wing hits the ground. And so he interviewed her later, and she goes, we do that over and over again on simulations, and I just followed the simulation. She didn't even hurt the plane because she did it so well. It was amazing to see.
That's really
cool. You know,
cool.
You had all the fire trucks out there for the foam and everything, and they did an emergency exit on the plane, but there was nothing wrong with that plane.
That's intense watching that. My goodness. Yeah, the pilots that can do that stuff manually are so impressive. The technology now, have you ever landed, gone somewhere, and it's like pea soup, fog, and the plane lands itself?
Yeah.
And they're like, the pilot be like, we're going to land by autopilot, and it's the softest landing you've ever felt. And you just before you touch down, you see the ground, and you're like, oh, my gosh, it's unbelievable. What would they do, you know? 50 years ago.
Yeah. There's a book by Nelson DeMille, and he did the research on it, and he had a 747 in his book, and the plane landed on automatic pilot. The pilots were killed, but the plane just came in all on its own and just landed automatically.
It's unbelievable.
So they have the technology now to do that.
Yeah. Now it's great. It's fantastic. Still terrifying. I was crapping my pants. Dave, can you tell us about a story from when you were on SWAT team, a memorable thing that you did?
Well, there was a lot of memorable SWAT team stories because San Bernardino County is the largest county in the United States, contiguous United States, 20,000 square miles. So sometimes we would get the call for the address and respond to the address, or sometimes we'd get a page out. We didn't have cell phones, so we paged out to the airport, and they put us on a helicopter and fly us to the site. The SWAT teams, they have high risk entries. They call them dynamic entries for search warrants and that kind of thing. But there's also a dynamic entry for SWAT where there's no hostage. It's barricaded suspect only kind of thing. But the most hair raising one is hostage rescues. And you don't get those too often because you negotiate for hours and hours before you got to go in. And throughout 9 years, I went on 4 hostage rescues, I think it was. A couple of them, one of them was out in Joshua Tree, and this deputy had pulled up to a house. It was a call of a child molest. And what it was, initially, there was a Marine sergeant who married this other senior Marine sergeant's daughter, and they lived in a house, in two houses that were right next to each other. And the daughter had been molested sexually by the father her entire life. Oh. So one day she told her husband about it, and he was irate. He went over into the house of his father-in-law, and there was some shots fired, and that's when the cops were called, and the patrol deputy pulls up, and there's a shot fired as soon as he pulls up. So they secure the house with the perimeter, and they call us. And this was way out in the middle of nowhere. So they actually put orange cones for us for the turns, because it was so dark. There's no street lights and there's no moon.
Yeah,
so
we middle of nowhere.
They tell us to take the first dirt road, you know, 3/4 mile past such and such a street. And then you're on the dirt. And then they tell you, okay, at the big rock, you take a left. And so they were putting cones out on these dirt paths for us to get there. So we get there, and we try to open negotiations. Nothing happens. Shots were fired, and the guy went in. So now we have possible injured. So they decide to do a hostage rescue. And this is the first time, and all the time I was there, that I disagreed with what they were telling me to do, because the front of the house had no concealment and no cover. Covers better than concealment, but there was not even any concealment. And so there was a light above the door we're going to enter. And they talked about it, about shooting it out with a Silenced 22 rifle that we have. And the two commanders, they were arguing, well, if we shoot it out, he knows we're going to be coming. That was the argument. So we had an entry team, and I was on the entry team, and two guys carried a gurney. So I think there was five on entry and two with a gurney, and we just bum-rushed the house. We got on our stick, and we ran up there, and we booted the door, and we threw in, I think, four flashbangs, because we knew the guy was a Marine expert. He had weapons, so we just flashbanged the hell out of it, and we go in there, and he found the husband dead, shot in the chest. And when the deputy had pulled up, that round that went off was the guy shooting himself in the head. So we found him both dead in the house.
Damn, that's intense, man. Yeah, shoot the light out, but he'll know. But then he'll also know if we run at the house.
Right. Another one was, I get a call out to a house, and I'm not going to tell it. I'm not going to say this city, but it's a small city. And I pull up, and I'm looking around, and I don't know if I told you this before, but they have their own SWAT team, and their SWAT team, the city SWAT team, was standing by. So I go up to my lieutenant, and I said, hey, what's going on? Well, what are we doing here if you got their SWAT team? And they said, oh, they don't want to do it.
I didn't know that was an option in police work.
Right. And so what happened was, this guy was on meth 5 days running. He's just a freaked out on meth. He's got an AK-47. Oof. He's got his entire family hostage. But the kicker was, the grandmother was on oxygen. So now you can't use tear gas and you can't use flashbangs on a guy with an AK-47. And the other city goes, oh, no, we don't want, this is going to go bad. So they said, we're not going to do a dynamic entry. We're going to do a stealth entry, like a SWAT entry. So we went in really on our hands and knees, and it took us 3 hours to crawl around that house until we found the guy. And luckily he fell asleep, and he was naked with his wife in a headlock and the AK-47 in his other arm.
Damn.
Yeah. But talk about, 3 hours of waiting for the guy to jump out with an AK or shoot through the wall, because that AK will go through 4 or 5 walls.
Right.
And kill everybody on the way through. So that was a harrowing type of SWAT call out.
Damn, Dave. You've done so many different kinds of police work. What do you think, looking back, what was your favorite assignment? Like, out of all these so far, like, what did you think was, like, the most enjoyable?
Yeah, I really like working the street. And I developed such a sixth sense for the crooks. I would prefer taking a marked unit out, because the crooks will react to the marked car. And if you watch for their very subtle reaction, you know which guy's bat, which crook is holding, right? So I want the undercover car. I want the plane wrap car. Give me the marked car, because I was getting more people with that marked car. So I enjoyed hunting in a cop car, in a marked car. I loved being a detective, the autonomy, because they would tell me many times, yeah, just go do what you want. Just go find the crooks.
Right.
So I got to just hunt them out. I don't know how many times I wrote one affidavit with five, six search warrants attached to one affidavit, and we'd hit places all at once. That was a lot of fun. And then the SWAT team, I was doing the SWAT team at the same time. So when you ask me that, I had fun at every aspect of my job.
Yeah, you can tell
I worked internal affairs.
Yeah, I want to hear about that too. But you can tell by the way you talk about it that you truly loved being a cop, like every aspect. You got into some crazy stuff. Now, let me ask you about internal affairs. Is this, because what most people know about internal affairs is like, you know, they're kind of like the police hall monitor. They're the tattletales, or you get caught doing something, you get sent to internal affairs. That's like a line from a movie. But I know a few friends of mine worked internal affairs at LAPD, and I know personally how important it is, and they took pride in it. They really wanted to police their own because they didn't want that stigma on police. What was the vibe where you worked, and why did you sign up for it? Or were you assigned to it?
No. You can't put in for internal affairs and get transferred there. They don't want somebody who wants to be there.
Makes sense.
Because they want people that don't want to, because they do a better job. You don't want a headhunter in there. You want your best investigator, in fact. And there are some things that are in books and in movies that aren't true at all. It may have been 50 years ago, but the biggest one I see in movies and books is, you have 25 years on. If they arrest you, you're going to lose your pension. I'm like, you don't lose your pension. If you're vested, if you got your 5 years in and you're vested, and 15 years in, and you do something stupid and go to prison, and a lot of cops have, they get their pension check while they're in prison. People don't understand that. They still get their pension. I did my worst part of the job was kids or women that are abused. Kids and women, I don't like that at all. And that was the worst part of the job for me. But when I got to internal affairs, it was just sad. I just felt like depressed all the time, because I held the job in high esteem. I always did. I wouldn't break the law, but I would walk on the laws that were a little bendy. You know what I mean? You could step,
sure,
move a line. And I made case law twice in my career doing that kind of thing. But I was interviewing my friends I worked patrol with, you know, 20 year friends. And it was just sad, because they would be angry. And one guy reached over and turned the tape recorder off and said, we used to do this same kind of thing when we were on patrol. And I said, times change. You got to change with the times. You can't do this. It was minor stuff for me. But another guy, he did something stupid, and he was really intoxicated. And I tried to tell him, he had a representative there. I tried, before I went on recording, I said, hey, look, you're looking at some heavy time, maybe 30 days on the bricks. If you just cop out to it and ask for, what do you call it, rehab. If you put yourself in retail, it was my fault, I want to go to rehab. They're not going to do anything to you.
Right.
And he started calling me every kind of name, that I was a rat. And we used to be really great friends. So that really hurt. Turned a tape recorder on, and he denied everything, said, blah, blah. And then they demoted him. They slammed him.
Ugh.
It was a terrible job.
Yeah.
So the undersheriff, because it's a sheriff and then the undersheriff, next to the second in command, he's the one that wanted me for that job. He said, you do a good job for me, and I will promote you. And I did it for a year, and I turned 50 years old. And when I was sitting at my desk one day, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. So I pulled up on a computer and applied for Hawaii 5-0. And that's when I did it. I applied for Hawaii 5-0 and flew out there, took the oral, and I went to work for them. Retired to San Bernardino, because I wasn't having that much fun anyway, because a sergeant on – I was a sergeant in Fontana, which is the hottest station in the county.
Fontucky.
And still, that's before I went to internal affairs. And it wasn't the same for me anymore because I was supervising people that were knuckleheads sometimes. They were doing some stupid things.
So you worked in Hawaii, Dave?
Yeah, I went to work for Y5O. I didn't tell you that?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah. So I applied for special agent for the Attorney General's office in Hawaii. I flew out there, and I applied for a lot of different jobs when I left because I've been to work for three agencies. I've been to a lot of oral interviews, and this was the most detailed oral interview I've ever taken, mostly on case law. And it was 2 hours long. And so they called me and said, yeah, I got the job. And my wife was from Hawaii, and that's why I did it, so she can go back there and live in the area of her folks. So I get there, and it was like a huge culture shock, because internal affairs, I was juggling 28 cases, and I get there, and they give me 4, 5, 6 cases a month. And so I would knock them out and turn them in, and then my peers, there were actually 50 agents, would come to me and go, hey, don't do them so fast. Go ahead and do them, but hold them for a month before you turn them in. You're killing us. So I said, no, man, I'm not like that. I got to be moving. Like a shark, I drowned if I stop. So my boss even came to me, my supervisor came to me, and he says, they're going to keep giving you cases until you say stop. And I said, I don't care. Give me the cases. So there was some unique things. When I first got there, I did a conflict case out of the DA's office, and it was an assault case. And I work it up, and I tell my boss, I show it to him. I said, I'm going to get a warrant, kick this guy's door and take him to jail. And he goes, whoa, we don't do that here. I go, what do you mean you don't do that here? He says, he looks at the calendar, and he says, call him up and tell him on Thursday. Come in on Thursday. We got the bus for the jail here on Thursday. And that's how they, because it's an island. They got nowhere to run.
Right.
So they call them up and say, here's your bus ride. Come in.
That's funny. Yeah. I mean, from what I hear about working in Hawaii is they really don't, on a patrol level, it's one of the only states where they won't take any kind of transfer because of the cultural differences. You have to go through their academy to kind of, because I'm sure they have a component built in where you learn about the history and the culture and, the norms so you can function as a cop. So would not having done that kind of just transferring in, did that get in the way, or did your wife kind of help you learn the culture a little bit?
No, I kind of learned it. It was so laid back. The culture of Hawaii is laid back. Everything is tomorrow. We'll do it tomorrow. We're not really interested in that. There was very few lawsuits. You have a car crash, and they the next day the person brings over a plate of brownies. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, thank you. It's okay. And that's how they dealt with things. It's a unique situation. I'm freezing up there. But it was still fun. I worked smuggling mostly and white collar crimes. Back then, and this was 2008, a pack of cigarettes was $11. So a carton was huge. I don't know what the price is now, but that was big money. So they were smuggling cigarettes in from the Philippines and China, and they would fly them in big boxes. And I got a lot of smuggling cases that way. But the cigarettes from there, they're trying to stop their people from smoking too, and they would put color pictures on the back of the cigarette pack of cigarette lungs or livers or whatever.
I've heard of that.
It's pretty gruesome. I did a major real estate fraud case because I was bored. Somebody was, because there's a call-in line, and the officer of the day gets the call-in line and writes down the cases that come in, and then it's handed to the whoever's in charge of that, and they would hand the cases out. So this guy's walking through the bullpen saying, anybody know what a 1031 exchange is? And I said, it's an IRS section. I said, yeah, I know what it is. So he gives it to me, and it's a huge stinker. But I wanted it because I was bored out of my mind. I would come to work, and the fake Hawaii 5-0 car was parked in my slot sometimes.
The fake?
The TV show, the Wi-Fi local, was parked in my slot because they were filming. Their office was right across from ours, the fake office was. So my office was on King Street. And if you know Oahu, there's the palace. Right across from the palace, there's the King Kamehameha statue. And then right next to that is the historical banyan tree. And then my office is right next to that. So they would put up the big tent and the catering for the Hawaii Five-O TV show right in the front lawn of where my office was. And they did it all the time. So one time I was on the phone with a witness, and they're having a fake shootout outside my window.
That's awesome.
So I was going somewhere with this. Oh, this 1031 exchange. What happened was this guy, there's a 1031 exchange is where if you sell your property, you don't want to take the hit on taxes. The money cannot ever touch your hand. The escrow can't close, and you receive the check. Otherwise, you pay taxes on it. So if you want to swap it for like or more expensive property, you can give it to what's called an accommodator. This is a catch in the IRS, and these accommodators popped up to accommodate these. So your escrow closes, your money goes to this accommodator, and then when your property, the property you find pops up, you take that money out, put it in escrow, and the money never touches your hands, and you never pay taxes on it.
Right.
So what this guy did was he took his impound account and he invested it unknowingly with a Ponzi scheme.
Ugh.
So he invested several million dollars of other people's money in a Ponzi scheme. And this was, the Ponzi guy was an ancillary to my case. He was like the catalyst for my case, but he was from Seattle area, and it was a big national case. It was in the news, and he ended up driving off a cliff and killing himself in Seattle area. So I get the case. I got to write all kinds of subpoenas, search warrants, and I go to the attorney general, the assistant attorney general is handling the case, who's our liaison. I said, this is what I want to do. I want to write search warrant on the guy, hit his house first, get evidence before he finds out that I'm on to him. He goes, okay, that's a good idea. So I come back, I start typing up the affidavit, and my boss comes to me and goes, change of plans. What happened was the guy that I was going after had too much influence, and everybody in the islands knows everybody. You can't do anything without going. It's like, it's a huge thing. So they want me to go outside and work my way in, which the guy's going to find out. So anyway, I do escrow subpoenas. I do bank subpoenas. I have a three-ring notebook, three-inch. It's already full of reports and interviews, and so I finally get a subpoena for his records, and I call Kauai, Bank of Hawaii in Kauai. I tell him who I am. I said, I want to come over and get the records of this guy, the main crook. And he said, okay, come over on such and such a date and ask for so-and-so. So I go to my boss, get a ticket, fly over there, rent a car, go into the bank, identify myself. Now I'm wearing an Aloha shirt and slacks. And I say, I'm here to get the records. And, oh, we're so sorry. She called in sick today. Ugh. And I said, all right, let me talk to your manager. So manager comes out. Oh, no, she's the only one that can do it. So now I'm stuck. And, I get my back up. So I look around the bank, and I look for the biggest chair. I find the biggest chair, and I drag it over to the center of the bank, and I just sit down. I sit down right in the center of the bank, and people are coming in looking at me. The tellers are all whispering and talking. And about 40 minutes, the manager comes over and goes, all right, I'll get you your records.
Here we go. Yeah, she's the only one. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, that's the guy. But then, every place I work, there seems to be weird stuff that happens. So this one agent, a special agent, is a good friend of mine. He says, I'm going to Molokai to do an investigation. And when I go there, my sister's indigent. And so I take her a case of canned goods. You want to go with me and check a case of canned goods so I can take two cases? I go, sure, I'll go with you. No problem. He needed somebody to go with him anyway for the investigation. So we go there, do the investigation. And then we get in a car and we drive to the the very end of Molokai. I don't know if you've been to Molokai, but there's nothing on Molokai. When the sun goes down, it is pitch black, but it is beautiful. So we go to the far end of Molokai. There's this single wall construction shack, and it's about halfway to the water. And so we park on a street. There's St. Augustine grass, like a carpet that goes up to this thing. And then on the other side, there's St. Augustine grass that goes out to the water. And it's in a channel between, I get the islands mixed up. I think it was Maui. Yes, Maui. On the other, you could see Maui. And so the water, there's, at that time of day, there's no, it was like a lake, just kind of lapping. Beautiful. It might have been a $10 million piece of property, right? And there's a single wall construction shack where his sister lives. And it's the family owns the property. So we go inside, go up these steps, go inside. I go inside the shack, and there are deer antlers interlocked all around the entire ceiling. I mean, hundreds of deer antlers.
Weird.
So he goes to his, he goes to talk to his sister. I'm talking to her husband. So I say, so you're a big deer hunter. He goes, oh no, I can't afford a rifle or the ammunition. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, well, I just wait till I hear the gunshots, and then I go down and get in my boat. That's what he says. So I go, what are you talking about? So what happens is the deer, there's a huge herds of deer on Molokai, and it's not hunted well enough because people don't know about it. But there are lots of deer. So they come down in a herd, and they can see Maui across the channel, and their depth perception, because they're animals, isn't sharp. So they think they can swim across the channel to Maui. So they get in a boat, they get in the water and start swimming, and that's when all the Hawaiians jump in their skiffs, and they drive out there and they start shooting the deer in the water and pull them into the boat. Well, this guy, he doesn't have a rifle, so he says he waits till the deer realize they can't make it, and they turn around. They're tired, and they turn around. He grabs them by the antlers and puts them underwater and drowns them.
Oh.
And
pulls them into the
boat. So he goes deer fishing. Now this is part of their culture now. You know,
yeah.
the deer, because he's supplying food for his table by doing this kind of cultural thing now.
Yeah, however you can get it done, right?
Exactly, however you can get it done.
Wow, that's nuts, Dave. I've had you on here for almost 50 minutes, but do you have time for one more violent crime story that's memorable to you?
Oh, I wrote a bunch of them down that we still had, because I listened to the last one, and there's still a whole bunch of violent crimes. Some funny stuff, too.
Yeah, let it rip. Whatever you think.
Here's one. This was when I first get the – I said this before. When I leave Ontario, I want to do more action, so I go to L.A. for the action. I get put in with a training officer for 6 months, and I can't avoid it. And he's very, very rude and harasses me and, you know, hazes me the whole time. So when I first get there, this is my second week there. This is my indoctrination to South Central Los Angeles. So he demeans me because he says I was a meter maid. He calls me a meter maid because I came from a small police department.
Nice.
He called me a meter maid. So we pull up to this. To pull up to this car, and I'd been in shootings and all kinds of stuff in Ontario. I got into some wild stuff there.
That's still a busy city.
Yeah. It was a fun place. So I played along. I was very diligent. So we stop on Wilmington Avenue. There's a red zone, and there's a van parked in a red zone. And he goes, "Get out and give him a ticket." And I said, "Come on, this is a 2-man crime car." So I get out, and there's a guy sitting in the front seat. This old, this real nice black guy. And so I bribe him a ticket, and I get back in the car, and I'm looking at the taillight pattern. And I said, I look at the ticket, and I said, the taillight pattern doesn't match the year that he gave me for the van, right? So I get out, I go up and run to bin number, comes back, and it's stolen. The van's stolen.
Nice.
So we tow the car, you know. My partner's going better, you know, and put him in the backseat of the car. Now, I'm the bookman sits in the LA County car, and he fills out the booking slip and all the paperwork on your way to jail. There's a little gooseneck lamp in the seat of the car on a passenger seat. So you're not looking up, and you're just writing, trying to fill stuff out. And I give him the medical questions, and he says, "Oh yeah, I got tuberculosis." So now we can't book him at the station jail. We got to go to LCMC, which is all the way downtown. So we divert. We tell dispatch we're diverting, and we haven't had dinner yet. So we're going to go through Taco Quickie at Imperial and Atlantic, or Century Atlantic, and we got the cook in the car. We're not supposed to be doing this. We drive through. We order some. He orders tacos. I order coffee. And I think we even ordered him a burrito in the back. And while we're in the drive-thru, I hear another guy who just got off training. When I came out, he got bumped. So he has 6 months on the street. I've got 4 years, but he's got 6 months on the street all by himself now. And he's a Linwood City car. And I hear him say, 251 to 251, Adam, go to channel 3. And I switch down just to listen, just being nosy. And he says, what was the description of that kidnap 207 kidnap robbery car out of Imperial Courts, which is the projects? The guy comes back and goes, "It's a silver AMC Hornet four door." And the other guy goes, "Go back to primary. I got the vehicle." So I suspect it's channel 22, and he comes on 251, 1033. He goes, I'm behind a 1029 Frank David armed and dangerous vehicle, and he says Century and Atlantic. He's at the intersection of Century and Atlantic. So I leaned out, my partner, both leaned forward because we're at the window of the Taco Quickie. We leaned forward, and we could see the crook's car, and we could see the patrol unit right behind him.
Oh, wow.
Right? And so, but we got somebody in the back seat and we're not supposed to get involved.
Oh, I'm sure.
So my partner says, we're just going to stay with him in case it goes bad until another car catches up and they can do a felony car stop. So there's four crooks in that Hornet station wagon. And they're armed with shot-off shotguns. So the light changes, the crook comes through the intersection, we pull out of the drive-through. And Frank pulls him, is still behind him. And I think when our car got behind the Frank's car, the crook realizes that they've been had. So they make a quick right turn and they accelerate. And now Frank gets on the radio and says, we're in pursuit. And now we got a crook in the back. We're in this pursuit with this guy. But the crook slows real quick. I mean, not three blocks into this. He hits the brake hard, the right passenger opens and a crook bails out and he's running and the car keeps going. So I got the cop car door open. I got my foot on the door. I got my gun out because I'm getting ready to go. And Frank pulls over and he bails out and the crook is running full blast and he's worried that the deputy's going to shoot him in the back. He's looking over his shoulder and he runs head on into a block wall. Bam, it goes down, right? So my partner goes, forget him. But he uses different words. We're taking a car.
Right.
So my car door comes shut, and we follow this crook down to Fernwood and take a left. And another cop car was coming up Atlantic to jump into the pursuit, and he sees us, but I forgot a part. Frank's brand new, so he calls northbound. He tells everybody we're going northbound on the street. We're really going southbound. So all our backup is going the other way.
Oops.
Nobody's coming to help us. Right? So Indian Joe is going north on Atlantic, and he sees our overheads behind this car, and he thinks, oh, well, we can't catch up with that one. We're going to stop it. We're just going to jump into this one. So we take a first left in Fernwood. We take another left, and as we're going up, another crook jumps out of the car, and my partner pulls his gun out, and he's driving. He's driving a car, driving a cop car, and the crook. The driver bails out. The driver bails out, and there's two crooks left. One left rear, and one right front. And the Hornet just keeps driving off by itself, nobody in it. And the crook's running across our peripheral to the left, and there's trees. This is the 105 freeway is right now. This was they raised the houses, but the trees were still there. And so my partner shoot at the window, bam, bam, bam. And we got a crook in the back seat still. And the car's filling up with gun smoke. And my partner turns and goes over the curb. And we're trying to catch up to this guy running around, driving around trees. And he's shooting out the window. And we hit this right when that starts happening, behind us, I hear ba-bam, bam, ba-bam, bam, a big shootout's going on behind us. And so we hit this divot, we come up airborne, all four tires, and we come down on this stump, and it tears the whole undercarriage out, the transmission, the differential, and we get out, we crawl out of the cop car, and the crook's in the back yelling, "Oh my God, oh my God." And my partner's going, "My gun, I can't find my gun." So I get in the back seat, pull the crook out, and he's okay. And he was laying on top of the gun because it had gone under the front seat and was in the back seat. So we get that all secured. The cop car is smoking, white smoke coming out of it. We go back, and the car, the other car, cop car that was behind us, he's driving up behind the Hornet, and he hears my partner shooting. So he thinks that he's being shot at from the Hornet. So his partner, his training officer, is standing up on the running board, holding on to this door's open, and he starts shooting at the Hornet. Well, his partner's a training officer, goes, "Whoa, you're not supposed to be doing that." And he slams on the brakes. So the door comes shut, and his partner goes down, and he screws his knee up pretty bad. So his partner puts out that we've had shots fired and his officer down, which was the wrong thing to put out.
Right.
So now everybody's coming, right? All three different stations are coming to back us. So what happened was the Hornet, without anybody driving it, it drives over the curb and runs into this block wall, and the other two crooks bail out and run. So we secure the area. We got plenty of help, secure the area. And because I'm the trainee, I'm with the sergeant. He's got a command post set up on his trunk, and we're sealing off, you know, we're putting units at different corners, setting up a perimeter, right? So the helicopter comes overhead, and it says, comes on station above us, and all of a sudden he comes on, he says, all ground units, we're losing oil pressure, we're coming down. And this helicopter, sheriff's helicopter, crash lands right beside me in this park. Comes, whoa, crashes right beside
what?
Me. This is my second week on the job. That's what's going on. It was a wild, and we didn't catch one of those crooks. They all got away.
That's insane. The poor guy in the back's got tuberculosis, and you're filling his lungs with gun smoke.
Yeah.
Damn.
That was a fun time.
That's insane. That you couldn't, like I always say on the show, you couldn't make that up if you tried. That's too many insane things happening.
Yeah, and I've been told that story in so long, I could have told it smoother, but that was basically the way it happened.
Oh, it's great. Well, the important part is, you guys get the food, or did you have to leave it there?
No, you know what? I think we pulled it in just as it was happening. So yeah, it was a big mess inside the car, because when we crashed that car, it was all over the place. Yeah.
Dave, that's totally insane. The exact reason I had you on here, but, I had no idea also that you went to Hawaii. That whole part of your life was like, somehow it's not in your bio, so I never asked it, but man, that's super interesting, man. Are you pretty much just in California now, or do you travel around for the books and signings and stuff?
We go wherever it takes me, we go. We go to conferences all over the place. I go to book talks. If somebody wants me for a book talk, I'll fly anywhere for a book talk.
Are you hooked up at all with Cops and Writers, that podcast?
Oh yeah, I think you know what, I did 7 podcasts right in a row. And yours is one of them. So I don't know. One was 2 Cops, 1 Donut. I remember
I've
that
heard
one.
Of that, yep.
Yeah. I did a bunch of them right now, so I don't know. I think so. I think I did that one. I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah, he's great, O'Donnell. He's a retired Baltimore sergeant, and he does a conference once a year, too. I figured you'd probably be like a perfect guy to be hooked up with that crowd. It's all cops who are becoming writers. They also mentor police officers who are getting into writing. Cause it's, I mean, the field itself is, especially a career like yours, kind of lends itself to like putting together either your memoirs or just from living those experiences, writing one hell of a novel. Cause you know how things happen, how they would go down. Cause you lived it. So, I can connect you guys if you're interested, but he does some talks and conferences and stuff. He's a great guy.
If there's some Moonlight Black, that's a second series I just started last October. It was a memoir I tried to write, but I couldn't get the story arc to work. So the first half of that book is true. I wrote it just the way it happened. because my first year at Ontario was just a wild time. And I tell people about what happened to me, and they said, oh, that never happens. So I put all that stuff in there. I wrote it just the way the first half. I mean, there's some exciting stuff in it, like, well, and a cop working in his own hometown. So, for example, for just a quick example, is I get a call of a naked man dancing in his front yard. I pull up, and the naked man, it was my psych teacher from high school.
Makes sense. Well,
you know, so I had to deal with that kind of stuff. And my mom showing up at one caper. But, yeah, so that book, and it's getting great reviews. People are really really like that book, Fierce and Moonlight Black.
It's a hell of a title. How'd you come up with that?
Because many times I was out on a scene and there's blood on the ground, and if you don't put flashlight on it, blood is black, right? And you know, without any light on it. So I just made the title up. It was a 3-book deal, so I gave them the titles right off: Here's some Moonlight Black, A Lonesome Blood Red Sun, and a gray cadaverous dawn.
Very cool. Titles. Very poetic titles. I like them. That's cool. So we're on right now. If you're listening to the podcast, you wouldn't know, but if you're on the YouTube channel where the interviews go, we have Dave's website up right now, DavidPutnamBooks.com. You can go there for everything David Putnam. And I'm guessing through your website here, there's links to the books. Looks like there is. And obviously in the show notes, we're going to put links to Dave's stuff so you can get them. He's got, 10 book series, right? The first one you did?
Scorn just came out, number 10, and 11 comes out in February next year, and I have 12 already done. And I just sold a third series that I had a lot of fun with, and it's called The Blind Devotion of Imogene, and it's a story of a woman who went to prison for murder at 63, and she gets out at 73, and she has to deal with all the things that a parolee has to deal with. And it's a fun book.
That's awesome. Man, you've written so many books, and they're not short books. It's like, it's got to be exhausting to keep doing that. I mean, obviously you'd love it.
Oh yeah. I've been writing since 1989, and I wrote 38 books before I sold my first one.
Yeah. That's the key, isn't it? You got to be perseverance, as they say.
Right. Right.
Well, Dave, thank you for coming on, man. Awesome stories. It's great to hear some more about your career. People can find you at DavidPutnamBooks.com. Do you have any social media or anything you want people to follow you on?
I have Twitter and Facebook, but I'm not that active on it. You can find me, though. You just type it in and I'll pop up. I have a newsletter that I put out every 2 weeks, but you could also get me on, email me. I'm happy to talk to anybody. And you can get me on my website, DavidPutnamBooks.com. There's an email where you can email me. Or my email is writedeputydave@yahoo.com.
Okay, and I can list that email in the show notes if you want people to be able to reach out to you easier. That's
great. And if anybody has any questions about law enforcement or writing, I help writers all the time.
Oh, that's awesome. So that makes me think even more that you should hook up with cops and writers. That podcast was made for you, brother. Absolutely. Dave, again, honor to have you on, man. Thank you for sharing some more of your stories from your career. And I'm going to do the outro here. Can you hang out for just like 5 minutes or 3 minutes?
Yes, sir. No problem.
All right, brother. I'll be right with you.
Okay.
The great David Putnam, ladies and gentlemen, second appearance. Guy's got the craziest stories. Some of his stories are like stories within stories. Honor to have him back on. Thank you to him for coming. Go check him out at DavidPutnamBooks.com. Guys, thank you for listening. Thank you for the rating and the reviewing. Thank you to the Patreon supporters that keep the lights on, keep the boat afloat. Which brings me to my next segment, which is when I thank the Patreon sergeants for all that they do supporting the show. Who I'm talking about is Christian, Brittany Sims, Elliot Sykes, Dave Ellman, Holly Vanover, Richard Tolles. And Richard Tolles, thank you for the Amazon gift card towards the show studio equipment. I love you, buddy. Joe DeVries, Raymond Arsenal, Doug and Kelly Newman, Bernie Boards, Derek Warden, Luke Shore, Scott Young, Wayne Miller, the great Nick News, Tom Connell, just Dennis, because that's all he put, Andrew Proctor, Luke Irving, George Tessier, Iceman from Motorcrop Chronicles, check out his podcast, Ilian Rogers, Cage Edgman, Andrew Horton, Greg Gabboy, Ben Peters, Trevor Daly, Rick McCormick, Scott Dinkler, Parker Brower, Tammy Walsh, Sean Clifford, Braden Walker, Sasha McNabb, Corey Payne, the great Mike Wynn, Nathan Gowan, Jason Lau, Dylan Pyrosic, the great Sarah Pomeroy, Lauren Simpson, Alec Wozick, Jake Pinedo, Sean Shoemaker, James Rose, Seth Wright, Tony Fahey, and William James Long. That's Deputy William James Long to you. That went a little bit long today because I didn't do the filter right, so I think I got some people in there that are no longer active. So that's a freebie. You're welcome. Guys, again, thank you for tuning in. The goal of the podcast is to share the stories from the men and women of law enforcement to get a better appreciation for what these people actually do on the job. It's quite incredible. So thank you for joining us, and I will see you next time.